Welcome to New Realities. My name is Alan Steinfeld, and each week on this program, I explore the leading edge in science, consciousness, and where we're going as an evolutionary species. And tonight, I'm interviewing someone who really, I feel, has a key to that evolution. He's Nassim Haramim, and he is a physicist with some new theories about time, space, and the nature of reality, as I call it. Nassim, thank you for being here. Hey,
thank you. It's great to be on the show.
Yeah, I know, and we've talked a bunch of times. And do you want to just mention this paper that you presented in Belgium? I think it was that actually got you a lot of notoriety. What did it involve, and what did people like about it?
Well, it won first. Paper award in the physics conference where I presented it in the fields of physics inside the conference, I should say. And it describes the atom as a mini black hole. It describes the atom in a completely different matter than the classical quantum point of view. And so it kind of turns everything around and describes the nuclei, the proton in the middle of the atom as a mini black hole, and describes the strong force thus as gravity between two mini black holes we call protons, and then calculates their velocity and their angular velocity and their frequency and so on, and comes up with the right values for measured values in laboratory for the nuclei of atoms.
Well, let me just fill people in. From what I understand of your theory, basically is that the universe is made up of nested black holes. So we go from the smallest object, which has a black hole, which depends on electromagnetism and gravity as its kind of two forces of the universe. But from the very small to the very large, it's black holes all the way down and all the way up. Is that basic?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, exactly. And, earlier papers I presented talk and describe the galactic and larger black holes. And then this paper addressed the quantum world black holes directly. Go ahead.
No, but I'm just saying people have such a weird understanding of black holes in research for this program. I was watching this little clip by Neil deGrasse Tyson, who runs the New York Planetarium, big scientist, and he wrote a book called Death by Black Holes. And he says if you go into the middle of a black hole, you'll be ripped apart. And it seems like it's a kind of very primitive and, I would say, sort of underdeveloped understanding.
Tidal gravity will do that. That's correct. The thing is that there is levels of standing waves of equilibrium on the outside of a black hole, where there's an equilibrium between what's pulling and what's pushing, and so you have stable states there. And and these stable states are what I've basically, it came early in my thinking when I was a kid, and I thought that maybe the atom could be divided to infinity, and then that would make the atom a mini black hole, and it would actually make the whole universe a black hole as well, and so on, and I realized it must be embedded black holes from infinitely big to infinitely small, and then it took me all this time to develop the knowledge base to be able to express the concept. But yes, there's definitely, it's correct to think of a black hole as something that absorb information and, has this destructive power, but at the same time, and this was my big contingency with black hole theories early on, the black hole must emit information in a coherent matter.
Right.
And that, you know, would mean that the white hole and the black holes are embedded within each other. They're not, you know, two universes apart, but that the white hole portion is on the outside and the black hole portion is on the inside. And there's an equilibrium. There's a state of equilibrium between what's coming out and what's coming in. There's a feedback. And that the information is not lost. It's conserved. And, you know, that gets into more details of information paradox and all this stuff. But definitely, you know, this new view transforms the way we think of black holes and the way we think of reality as a whole, if everything is a mini black hole.
Well, that's what I'd like to talk to you about. First of all, that the fact that black holes in most, seems like most physicists consider it an anomaly, and you're saying it's the very foundation of the universe.
That's right. Yeah.
And then the thing about reality is, if your theory is true, and it seems to be, how, and if it's accepted, how does this understanding change how we think about who we are? You know, science has always influenced the kind of popular concepts. I mean, Einstein changed everything with his theory. So if your theory is really accepted commonly, how will it affect us sociologically and psychologically as well? That's what I'm interested in.
Right. Well, you know, it definitely change, it interestingly joins with most of what has been said by masters throughout the ages, you know, from Buddha to Krishna to Jesus and all the rest, you know, talking about infinity or God being in everything and so on, and, you know, the infinite potential of everything and so on. In many different cultures, from many different masters, it joins with that view. But it defines it in a non-dogmatic view, meaning that it's defining it in actual physics and mechanics. That, you know, this understanding, when it's, you know, when you realize that you're made out of 100 trillion cells, which are made out of billions of atoms, and, you know, you start to realize that you're made of these little singularities with infinite nature, then you start to connect with the infinite nature of your existence and the deeper meaning of life and the deeper meaning of your life relative to the universe and the relationship of your life with the universe and how you influence it and how it influences you. And, you know, all these things start to come into focus. And really, I think that it equates, you know, the path of a master to its higher potential, you know, towards having this awareness of this infinite nature that we have.
So you're saying if your theory was accepted commonly in the way that Einstein's is, we would have a much greater spiritual orientation to reality.
Yeah, we would. However, in that case, we might not call it spiritual because it's literally physics of the universe that dictates it. And it's, you know, I've always said, you know, the spiritual world is the physics we haven't understood yet.
Right.
And, you know, that, I think this new view starts to understand it better. And it understands it in fundamental mechanics and actually, you know, quite Newtonian and Einsteinian classical views. And it actually grounds the whole spiritual concepts to actually fundamental structure of creation, and so that the spiritual concept has application in the real world, you know, directly, that like mathematics and physics can be written. And I can give you an example, for instance, that paper makes the proton a mini black hole by exchanging energy with the energy of the vacuum that's present everywhere and that's calculated and demonstrated in the laboratory. And this vacuum energy is a density of 10 to the 93 grams per centimeter cubed, which is enormous. It's 39 orders of magnitude than all the universe stuffed into a centimeter cube of space. So it's a very dense energy that we call the vacuum in
right.
the atomic level. And
which exists everywhere in creation. I mean, everywhere. It's everywhere.
That's right.
Okay.
And
so.
It connects all things. And so when you actually take the amount of vacuum energy, the density of the vacuum inside the volume of a proton, you find the exact mass of the universe, showing that all the universe protons are entangled through the vacuum structure and connecting every single proton in the universe. And that, you know, gives a meaning to the concept that we're all one. And that's what I mean by grounding a concept into an actual fundamental actualization and understanding of the mechanics of it. And
I see. So if you prove that these protons are all connected and entangled and they're everywhere, then through that sort of singularity of the proton, it fuses all of creation into a...
That's right, so that all of creation knows what creation is doing so that it can produce very complex systems like our biological entities and so on, and look back at itself and try to figure itself out.
Uh-huh. Is a neutron then a sort of a fusing of a proton and an electron together, in your terms?
No.
What is a neutron?
Proton is a little black hole with a singularity at the center that we call quarks. And the electron cloud is the effect of the little black holes interacting, you know, producing field effects, electromagnetic fields that we call the electron. And
what's a neutron then?
Well, the neutron and the zoo of other particles is the relationship of the little mini black holes together and the topology of the surface of the event horizon of those black holes. It gets a little complex there, but
mm-hmm.
basically the surface of a black hole can be considered like a membrane of information and that relates to the entropy of a black hole. And
like an event horizon, you're saying.
Yeah, like an event horizon has discrete pigmentation
uh-huh.
that you can count as bits of information, if you'd like.
Hmm.
And that gives you an idea of the entropy of a system. And without getting too much detail...
I know.
Many of the... subatomic particles and the dynamics, you see the atom in the nuclei of atoms and the particles that are there is because of these information bits and in the structure of mini black holes.
Mm-hmm.
And that these things, you know, and that's why the electron has spin at near the speed of light and that there's constant energy and this constant dynamics and, you know, that... atoms are very stable and, you know, last very, very long times and so on, you know. Typically in the classical view is unexplained, for instance. It's in the standard model, there's nowhere where it explains where the magnetic field, you know, the charge and the angular momentum, the angular, you know, the spin comes from, and so on. There's no explanation of the source of the material world other than it came out of the Big Bang, which doesn't tell us anything about it.
Right, because the Big Bang is really sort of a religious doctrine of, like, the biblical explanation of the universe. They haven't really evolved in science, so... But what you were saying, I mean, my opinion, and based on what I've heard you say, but... when you go through a black hole, you're saying there's a white hole on the other side. Is that in a different universe or dimension?
The white hole is the electromagnetic component that radiates around the black hole, which is in the middle.
So it can be measured, that white hole, then, right?
Yeah, we call it a star, a galaxy, an atom, a subatomic particle, or universe.
I see.
Yeah.
But if you went through the black hole, where would you end up? Because
If you connect with the structure of the vacuum, which, you know, you see, in this view, the black hole membrane, the event horizon is a torus. It's not a sphere. So when you go along the surface of a torus, you end up in the middle eventually. And in the middle of a donut, a torus, what's there?
What's there in the middle of the donut? The emptiness?
The hole. Very good. Yeah, exactly. The vacuum, the space. And this is at that dimension with the Planck's length, the space is fluctuating with all the intensity of all of the oscillation of the universe. And so when you're there, you can go anywhere in the universe.
But can you actually go there? Because doesn't time get bent, out of shape, and what happens to consciousness, too?
Well, it's like, you can imagine it this way. It's like going to the moment of absolute present for all things.
Right.
So if you go to the moment of absolute presence for all things, you can jump from one present to another.
Mm. Or, right, because there only is presence.
Right, exactly. For all things, and the thing that connects all those presents is the vacuum, is the space between them, all these points, and so when you go into that space, then at singularity, then you have access to all other present, so you can transport yourself.
But how much does consciousness really play in your science? You're talking about protons and Planck's constant and all that, and then there's this thing, and it's the problem with science in general, there's this thing which we call awareness or consciousness that seems to be left out of these equations. But I think you're kind of integrating it somehow, but how are you?
Well, what I was saying is that there's a white hole and a black hole. And the white hole is an electromagnetic radiative field. And the black hole part is the gravitational collapse towards the center. And the two are in feedback. This is why information can come out of the black hole. The two are shaking hands. The two are transferring information. So the information is either going out, like experiencing and modifying the world outside of you, or the information is coming in, like you absorbing information from the outside world.
And it's affecting me then, yeah.
That's right, and now it's affecting you. And that, feedback, that relationship is what I believe we call consciousness. And actually, it's occurring at the highest level of physics, is the fundamental forces of gravity and electromagnetism that moves the information into a feedback. And that, so now you have some fundamental dynamics, fundamental forces driving the information network that we call the conscious interaction, the self-awareness, which demands feedback.
Well, wouldn't that happen on all levels of nature? Going off like this point a little bit, I was watching a video of you, I think from 2003, where a comet was coming in and towards the sun, and the sun put out this flare to push this comet away, as almost as if the sun had an intelligence of its own.
Right.
Am I going too far out there to say that this consciousness actually inhabits things like suns and stars, or would you not?
Well, I would say that consciousness is happening everywhere. It might be in different forms, it might be in different resolution of the complexity, and I think that's relevant, and it's certainly in different scales. I think that when you look at the universe this way, you start to realize that the system is self-supporting. It's all going towards further and further complexity. You see it in nature everywhere. And, you know, further and further refinement. And you could think of the human being as like the, you know, the end point of the refinement for our planetary system, anyway, in terms of, you know, our capacity to become self-aware and, you know, to have, to be able to self-examine, but certainly not the only ones. I mean, there's lots of evidence that dolphins are able to self-examine and so on. And so,
and other beings from other places, supposedly, that have visited or, yeah.
Right, there's lots of evidence for that too, that cannot easily be discounted at this point.
But does something happen to this feedback mechanism when it, or the black hole nesting, when it reaches the biological state that doubles its awareness or increases its sense of awareness? Because it seems like there's a jump from, you know, inorganic to organic or biological material, right?
Right. Well, you know, there's a jump, but when you look carefully, you know, it's basically inorganic materials arranged in such a way that they produce what we call organic. But, you know, at the end of the day, it's a bunch of minerals with water in it, you know, and, you know, chemical interactions and so on that produces the so-called organic world. And you can't really explain the organization at the organic world without looking at the atomic level that produces it. And that's what's really important, and because the, you know, for instance, in the organic world, you know, in biology, there's no explanation for cell you know, division, you know, in terms of differentiation, you know, cell differentiation and the self-organizing systems are not addressed in our current theories. And so what I'm suggesting is that the organization comes from the atomic and actually the vacuum structure that produced the atomic level as well. And that the fractal nature of the space is what eventually, you know, produced the beautiful rendering of a tree or, you know, a bird.
So the very, so you're saying the very fabric of the biology and who we are as self-aware beings is built into the smallest, structures of the universe because of the dynamics, that exists on that level.
Yeah, you can't separate the material, you know, the atomic level from the biological level, and you can't separate the atomic level with the vacuum structure, you know, and so they're all interrelated, and it's a holistic view that's necessary in our science to understand the relationship between the different scales and how the universe produced self-organizing, you know, extremely complex systems with apparent ease and very rapidly, cosmologically talking.
But what seems to have thrown off, like, the quantum physics and a lot of people in Einstein is this relationship between time and space. And I don't hear you talk so much about time in your theories. And can you kind of include that? And then how does it affect this feedback mechanism if time is sort of distorting, or maybe it's not, but do you know what I'm asking there?
Right. The time is actually, you know, a function of the feedback itself. It's like the future is informing the past, which is informing the future. You know, I'm in the middle, actually, of writing some of the math for this. It will hopefully be included in the next paper I'm publishing. And, you know, this feedback about between the electromagnetic field and the gravitational field defines that time function that is very crucial to, you know, describing the topology of the field and everything that I'm talking about. Space-time is very involved. And,
But there is a predestined future. I mean, there's a future that you're saying has happened according to your physics.
It's a bunch of probabilities then it's going to get a little complicated. If you want it, I try to give you the quick view. You can imagine that if you have a set of math that gives you a linear answer, and feed it back and get infinite amount of complexity, that means that the feedback of space and time would produce infinite amount of future possible, right?
Like looking into a mirror, like in that kind of like two way.
Right.
Okay, I get that. Like a mirror inside a mirror. Yeah.
That's right.
Yeah.
So that produces like a feedback in which structure emerges. There's, you know, division of the space, like you're looking at each mirror as a, like, a little feedback loop that is completed. And each one is scale. When you look at the mirrors, they're getting smaller and smaller and smaller and smaller in the distance, right? And it's the same thing when you take a camera and you point it back at the monitor, which is a fun thing to do.
You get this abstract form.
Mm-hmm.
So is that happening all the time to us?
Yeah, that's right. That's what we call our reality, actually, this feedback in the structure of space-time itself. And when we look at it that way, it becomes clear that creation is not one big bang, but a cycle, continuous cycles of bang.
Because if the present exists and it's only present, then the future present will be just as much a present as this present, and we'll get this kind of feedback, this infinite feedback to this presence from all those other presences.
That's right. Very good.
That just came to me as you were speaking. So
right.
I get that. So that is how, in a way, consciousness or what we're aware of presence can have an impact on this feedback mechanism, right?
That's right. Because our little point of present is influencing all the other present.
And it's influencing the past and the future, so...
That's right, as a result, right.
So are there timelines? Are there different timelines that bifurcate from this moment, or do you believe that there's only one timeline?
Well, the timeline is defined by the interaction of all timelines. The system is learning about itself. And so, you know, it's a consensus reality. Otherwise, we would all be in our own reality. Uh-huh. You know, when people say you create your reality, well... You create your reality, but then reality is creating you too. And so there's a feedback.
Right.
Because if you created your own reality, and that everybody did that,
right?
You'd be alone, you know, in your own reality. So there's a consensus, and that's what defines the timeline.
Uh-huh. So the consensus. The other question that comes up when I listen to your lectures is that because you're saying there's only two forces, electromagnetism and gravity, and there's no strong or weak force, that's one thing. But then Einstein says that gravity bends light, and you're saying everything is a black hole. So are we really looking at the bending of light as it's approaching a black hole? Is light bending because it's approaching a black hole?
Correct.
Is that why? Uh-huh.
Yeah. Space-time is curved.
Space-time is curved, so...
Right. And what I'm saying by...
Yeah, tell me.
By what I'm saying by everything is a black hole is that space-time is always curved. There's no place where the space-time is flat. That doesn't exist. And, you know, because there's no place where there's no mass, there's no, you know, curvature. And so that means that, you know, everything is warped, and so you could go, you can go from any place to any other place. I can give you another example. Imagine this. You're trying to measure the movement of your hand from A to B, right?
Yeah.
Well, if you take the standard approach, the first thing you're going to have to do is isolate the system. So you're going to say, I'm just going to look at the hand moving relative to me, right? But actually, if you say, well, you know, you look up in the physics book, what is a closed system? You will find the first thing it says is that no such thing has ever been found. You know, nothing can actually be isolated completely from everything else.
But the Newtonian laws are based on closed systems, but that's another discussion, right?
Right, that's another discussion. But in, in this case, then, you know, you have to say, well, when I'm moving my hand from A to B, I'm on a planet that's moving. So I got to add that curve. I got to add that, you know, acceleration to my hand. And then my, and then the Earth is moving around the sun. And then I got to add that. And then the sun is moving inside the galaxy, right? So now I've got to add that. And now my hand is moving extremely fast from A to B. I mean, you're talking millions of miles per second. And, you know, now, you know, I got to add the movement of the galaxy inside the cluster, that's inside the supercluster, that's inside the universe. And assuming a fractal universe, meaning that this universe is embedded into a larger one, which is embedded into a larger one, so on, eventually my hand's moving at the speed of light. So is my hand actually moving? Well, I actually have to look at my hand in a different way if I want to solve this problem. If I have an open system, which is the way the universe seems to be, then I got to look at my hand in a different way. I got to think my hand is actually undoing and redoing and undoing and redoing and undoing and redoing really, really fast. It's disappearing. It's becoming the vacuum and then becoming the matter and becoming the vacuum and becoming the matter very, very fast along a path that makes it appear like it's moving across the space. Did you get that?
Is this what Max Planck's called the quanta? Is that what he referred to?
Well, it could be associated with the quanta, you know, but it's scalable.
I didn't really get why if it's moving so fast, does it flash in and out or off and on like that?
Well, because if, you know, if everything is the present all at once, like you figured out a few minutes ago,
and
this, you know, all you have is presence. So your the system is doing one present after another present after another present, along a linear line that makes it appear like it's moving. But it's just like a movie, you know, you have 32 frames per second and it appears like a smooth motion, but there's actually spaces in between. And we know that the electron and the positron, right, are constantly appearing, disappearing, oscillating between the vacuum and, you know, the charge state. And so you get this, you know, you get this fluctuation of reality, you know, that's occurring. And you realize that reality is actually just an oscillation of the space itself.
So what happens in those in between? So like frames in a film, what happens in between those points that were not here?
That's how the system informs the vacuum. That's how you transfer the information of your interpretation of your present in the structure of the vacuum, and that's how the whole system becomes informed of everything else. And then when it comes back out, then it informs the singularity of the state of all of the rest of the universe so that it's absolutely coordinated.
Oh, and so are you saying it forms these little, in the moment we form these singularities and in those other beats we kind of dissolve into the everything? And then
you could think of it as you during the day you're awake, at night you're asleep.
Uh-huh.
You know, you can see it in many different ways.
Or like a particle and wave, would you say it's like
that's
that?
Right. Yeah, or yeah, I mean, that could get a little complicated that way as well, but, you know, I'm trying to...
Or like drops in an ocean, like you know, suddenly we're the drops and then we're the whole ocean or something
that's
like
right.
that.
That's right. Yeah, exactly. Okay. And then you're the drop again because you evaporated or something, you know, on a longer cycle. But imagine happening it very, very, very fast, like at the speed of light.
I see. So that's it. Yeah.
Yeah.
But
and
So these two forces, gravity and electromagnetism, are the dance of the universe, and where it seems like where gravity dominates, and there's less of an electromagnetic pull, you get these black holes, right? Because that's pure gravity.
Right. Singularity. Mm-hmm. Yep.
Singularity is only gravity without that electromagnetic force. But what informs the length of the black hole, the event horizon? I mean, you have these nesting holes, and if you have, you know, pure gravity, what kind of confines the limits of that, I guess I'm asking, you know?
Well, it produces scale because there's a relationship between the collapsing black hole and, you see, when it collapses, it doesn't just collapse, it has a spin, it produces a torque, it is a gradient in density that's occurring, so it's like a little vortex.
That's also why light bends, actually, probably.
That's right,
right.
Exactly. Uh-huh.
Just the nature of the universe, but right?
That's
the bending.
Right.
Okay, go ahead.
Right. And so when the angular velocity gets to certain levels, then, you know, the centrifugal force can take over, and now you have information spraying out from the system. Some is falling in, some is spraying out, and the part that's spraying out we call the electromagnetic field. And, you know, that becomes the fundamental feedback, and as the information sprays out and experiences the field outside singularity, then it has entropy, it loses momentum, it starts to curve back, the gravitational field starts to take it back, and thus the torus nature of the field, and it brings it back into singularity and back out and so on. And that's how the system learns about itself. Because every time it makes a loop, it comes back a little changed.
With more information.
That's right. The whole of the universe has more information because it just got fed new information, and you have more information because the universe fed you back the result of you feeding your information.
So the universe is always evolving then?
That's right. It's a learning system, and you can see it in nature everywhere. The system learns about itself, certainly, and adapts, and, you know, it's very efficient.
So there's no heading towards entropy or an unlearning or a collapse of
the
system?
Entropy is only half of the equation. Syntropy is the other half. Entropy is the information moving out. Syntropy is the information moving in towards infinite potential.
And what about this whole idea of dark energy and dark matter? Because you deal with that, but because no one else has been able to solve it. They say 95% of the universe is unseen and undetectable, made of this dark stuff, but what do you say?
Well, I say the problem is not some kind of weird matter that doesn't radiate, that just happens to be in the right quantity at the right places to make our equation work. What I'm saying is the equation is wrong. Well, it's not necessarily wrong. It just doesn't consider all the players involved, and one of the major player involved is the structure of the vacuum and the energy of the vacuum, which is not being considered. And when you consider that, then the picture of the universe changed dramatically, and you realize that gravity is not the weakest force, as it is in the standard model today, but is actually the strongest force. It's the force that binds all atoms. And, you know, that's a definitely a radical view, and that's why I was very excited to see that my paper won this award. And, you know, it definitely is, you know, it demands flexibility to address it, but it's very powerful, it's very simple, and it solves some of the largest unification problem that science has encountered.
So you're saying if gravity is the strongest force and it really hasn't been accounted for, then this idea of dark energy and dark matter doesn't exist at all. We just haven't accounted for the
That's right. We haven't accounted for the torque and the Coriolis effect of the structure of space-time. And, you know, the more complex surfaces of black holes, we've made, you know, very crude approximations with ideal systems. And, you know, so, like, for instance, we have an atom with an electron spin that continuously spins for billions of years with no accounting of where the energy is coming from to produce such an effect, or the magnetic moment of the atom or the angular moment of the atom or any of these things are not given. They're just assumed. And when you do an appropriate accounting of what goes on, then the number starts to look different again. And
the whole
matter and the dark energy problem goes away.
I see. The other thing I want to talk to you about, if you want to talk about it next little time, is this practical application of your work, because it's great that there are theories and, you know, science and theoretical physics, but what is so amazing about you is that you've been able to, if you want to share some of that, to put this into really practical application. And
I mean, there's definitely possibilities for really amazing technology. I mean, if we understand the structure of the vacuum, the structure of space-time in a deeper manner, and we understand how curvature occurs and deeper understanding of the, you know, creative function of our reality, and then we can start to engineer, you know, devices and instruments to replicate that and tap into or connect with this natural, you know, creative force that's everywhere around us, that is us, literally. And, you know, and all of a sudden, instead of going around thinking, oh, my God, there's not enough space and we have to fight for terrain and there's not enough energy in this world, I think that view is going to get completely to reverse to, oh, my God, there's, like, infinite amount of energy for everybody and an infinite amount of exploration to be done. And that just demands us understanding these fundamental forces better and applying these understandings to advanced technology and so on. And so I think there's a great potential for humanity. I think we're at the breaking point. It's a very, very important time in our evolution.
Uh-huh. But they say, you know, if we're to really play with these energies, we need a tremendous amount of fuel, of energy. But it seems like you also said, nature is full of this energy. So it has to do with the way we're thinking, the paradigm of our disconnection to nature, in a sense, isn't it?
Right. Or disconnection with the natural. If we observe nature very closely, it's quite, you know, efficient at using that energy. And all we have to do is understand how it does it a little better so that we can replicate it, and then that energy will become available to us. It's the energy of creation. It's obviously there because Big Bang or not, I mean, whatever theory you're going to use, at one point you're going to have to, admit that there's huge amount of energy going on everywhere. I mean, look at the sun, look at galaxies, look at atoms and so on. And, you know, that energy must come from somewhere. So if we understand where it comes from, and I'm proposing that it comes from the space itself, then, you know, we understand how to use it and we can transform our world and our relationship to the world and our understanding of the world and the universe as a whole. And that can produce a very advanced civilization. I think a civilization that would be quite peaceful, actually, because many of these many of the wars and the problems we're experiencing is because of the belief that there is limited amount of goods and limited amount of space and that we have to fight for it.
So how far away, I mean, do you think a technology based on this is imminent? Do you think it is.
I think it is imminent. Absolutely. Mm-hmm. I think it's imminent. I think it's happening. And, you know, I think people should be very happy. I think it's very, very exciting. It's a very exciting time. And humanity is going to make a choice. You know, we're either going to transcend this difficulty and move into an ideal society, you know, or we're not going to make it the way we're doing things right now. So it's like, it's really a choice that's being made as a whole by everybody.
But what has to change in our thinking in order to make that choice to move forward?
Well, mostly it's got to be flexibility in our thinking, you know, being open to new ideas, being open to new understanding, and seeing where they lead and how they can be applied and so on. It demands as well, you know, and you can see that happening. I mean, there's a maturity that's occurring, you know, that it's a very powerful time in history. A transformation is occurring very, very rapidly. I can give you an example. I mean, like, how many people 4 years ago thought that we were going to have a African-American president, you know,
right.
And so on. And, you know, so it's happening very rapidly, and I think we're really at the breaking point to, like, move into a new direction. And it just demands a certain amount of flexibility. It's like the chaotic time before the new order, you know. It's like when you oscillate a system on your bench, you know, lab bench, you know, it will oscillate and go into further and further chaotic mode, and, you know, you think it's going to rip apart, and boom, all of a sudden it goes into resonance and it gets into a new frequency, higher levels of energy and so on. And so that, I think, is where our society is at this point, and we're just about to transcend.
Well, okay, so you go to these science conferences and you meet these professors and these physicists who are steeped in like a 100-year paradigm of these four forces of the universe, and they have all this, and they're just trying to work out the little details. And then you come along and you say, it's not like that at all, guys. And what do they have to let go of to embrace what you're telling them?
A lot. It's taking, you know, I've been going at it for 20 years, and, you know, it takes a long time, and it's understandable. They're not going to just drop, you know, some 100 years of physics, because especially at my age, I'm fairly young, you know, when I was coming at them 20 years ago, I was, you know, in my early 30s, and I was debating with physicists that were in their 50s, 60s, 70s, and some in their 80s, and, you know, they had a lot, very seasoned and so on. So it takes a lot of time, and, you know, certainly I got turned around many times, and I still do. However, there's more and more people from prediction I made, you know, at the time, that, like, I realized that my picture of the universe is, you know, not only getting confirmed in observational evidence in cosmological way in many places, but that it is becoming more and more palatable based on what we're finding in experiments and so on, here too. And so, you know, it's starting to gain more and more popularity, you know, and it is very, it is challenging for, you know, the standard model, absolutely. And but I think that at the end, with a few modification of the standard view, I'm not using anything voodoo, the view of physics can be modified just a little bit, and all of a sudden a whole new world opens up when you start to realize that we're living in embedded singularities from infinitely big to infinitely small, which our universe currently obeys the condition of. What I mean by that is that if you take the mass of the universe, 10 to the 55th gram, and you put it in the bubble of our universe that we know approximately the size of, it obeys the condition of a black hole. You know, we live inside a black hole.
So it's actually probably a bigger black hole that this universe is a part of then.
That's right. Exactly. And then a bigger one again and so on.
Ad infinitum. But also
that's
smaller
right.
black holes than the Planck's constant, which is the smallest thing we can measure as right now, right? So
Right. The Planck's constant, which may be the smallest limit for our scale of observation.
Right. So from where we are, and you said the biology is right in the middle, basically. But I also want to ask you about, you've talked about ancient civilizations actually having come to these conclusions as well. What have you seen?
Well, in many different ancient civilizations, there's these texts and these knowledge base and these teachings that talk in very similar terms about the universe, and that actually describe the geometry of it and, you know, the dynamics of it and so on. And I found that many of these concepts match some of the information and the equations I write. And it was inspirational at first to find this. And I'm not the only one that looked at it that way. Isaac Newton Newton studied Kabbalistic texts, even learned ancient Hebrew to translate some of them and built a replica of the Temple of Solomon and so on. And he believed that fundamental principles of nature were embedded in these texts and these buildings and so on, and the engineering of the buildings and so on. And he was very clear that he got most of his ideas about motion and gravity and so on from studying these ancient civilizations. So this, actually I didn't know that when I was doing my studies on ancient civilization, but I was finding it very remarkable, like so many ancient knowledge was so advanced in their thinking about the universe and the structure of space and so on. And I thought that was very relevant to advanced physics.
One more question I have just before we're out of time is this idea of this, for a long time the mechanistic view of reality was that it was objective and you could measure it, but it seems like since Einstein everything was relative or basically based on reality is subjective. How does your theory fit into this more subjective experiential view of the universe?
Well, I would say that everything, that it's always both, that everything is subjective because it's always an interpretation of a point in a view, like a frame of reference in the whole system. Mm-hmm. However, each moment is objective because it is all the combined, all the subjective information combined, producing a present which is objective. It's a very defined set of information.
So you're saying it's always both. The feedback, like you said before, the universe, we're creating reality and reality is creating us.
That's right. And it's like the chicken and the egg. You can never get rid of the chicken or the egg. You know, it's always both. You can never have a space-time without mass curving it, and you can never have mass without space-time. So it's always curved. There's no flat space.
So what's your work coming up look like? Your work, like, in the future? Like, where does it take you?
Well, my next paper I'm very excited about. It's going to describe the information network of the membrane of the structure of the event horizon of the little proton. Well, of black holes in general. And resolve some of the issues about particle creation and all this stuff and information paradox issues and all this stuff. And I'm really excited about this paper. I look forward to publishing it because this last one I just published was really, it's actually very simple. Any student with maybe a first year of physics can can understand it. It's classical and semi-classical mechanics. And so, you know, I'm really looking forward into getting into the entropy and the thermodynamics and the information network. All this I'm preparing, and it's looking so sweet. I'm just so excited to publish it. So I'm looking forward to that next paper, and I'm touring. I'm giving talks. I've been touring for almost 4 months. I've been in Europe, and I talked on many radio shows, including yours. Mm-hmm. So I've been, very busy with that. Talking to the public is remarkable. The public is so well informed nowadays and so excited, and they understand. And, you know, it's really, I even show many of the equations, and I talk through the people through the equations. And I've got people in there that hated math and physics all their life, but they really enjoy it because it makes sense to them and it's simple. Mm-hmm. And so I'm really enthusiastic. I've met so many remarkable people in these four months and so on, and more to meet.
And you're doing an intensive as well in Joshua Tree in October, right?
That's right, a 2.5 days intensive that I call the delegate program that's occurring, you know, in the end of October, on Halloween weekend, actually. And it's in Joshua Tree in Southern California, and it's going to be a wonderful event, and I really look forward to it.
And it's all on your website, theresonanceproject.org.
Correct, theresonanceproject.org. You can find all the information you need out there, and actually all the papers I've published as well are there, and you can look at those, and there's layman articles, and there's a blog you can participate in, and there is, and we're working on expanding all this as fast as we can, so... and you can purchase a DVD as well. A four set DVD with some 8 hours of information on there, and right off our website. And so, very exciting.
Wow. So this new paper people will access. You're saying that the membrane of the black hole has a topology, has a texture to it.
That's right, it's not smooth because there's Coriolis effects and there is fluid dynamics and that these produces various degrees of freedom that, that describe the relationship between the vacuum and the information. How the information goes to the vacuum and how the vacuum feeds the information back. And at the atomic level, we're using that to describe the zoo of particles that are found, you know, in the accelerator when they collide what I call mini black holes together.
But on a larger level, it may, talk about the asymmetry that scientists can't understand why the universe is asymmetrical.
Right. That's right. Well, you know... They call it asymmetrical because they find, you know, first of all, that is contrary to Einstein's approach, but they find regions that are much more dense with, galaxies and stars than other regions. And so it appears asymmetrical that way. But if you were to zoom out, you might find that there's symmetry, right? In the structure, is just that the structure is so immense that...
Right, we're too close to it, yeah.
That's right. So it's just like if you have your nose in the Persian rug, you're not going to see the pattern.
Yeah. Well, no, I think your work is amazing, fascinating, and truly a new paradigm that if people integrate it, we really would have a new planet, a new heaven and a new earth.
Thank you. I appreciate it. I think we're, you know, everybody's... transforming very rapidly, and we're all doing it together. It's very exciting to see.
And we need to, like you said, this is like the hour.
Yeah, it's the 11th hour. We're doing great, you know, we just gotta keep going.
Well, Thank you. Thank you for, being out there and being a warrior and standing for what you know to be true.
Thank you. I appreciate it. Yeah. And thank you for all the support out there. And I definitely enjoy your show, and I appreciate you having me on.
Thanks. And you might be in New York in the next couple of months, huh?
I may be, actually, yes. Look for me in New York, maybe in November. I'm unsure about that, but there's floating dates.
Okay, let me know, because I'd like to hook up, with some scientists here, like we talked about, okay?
Okay, yeah, absolutely.
Okay, great, Nassim. I've been talking to Nassim Haramein. How do you say your last name, actually?
Haramein.
Haramein.
I know it's a tough one. Yeah, Haramein.
For the residence, theresidenceproject.org. This is Alan Steinfeld, right? Residenceproject.org. This is Alan Steinfeld for New Realities. If you want to reach me, go to my website, newrealities.com, or email me at newrealities@earthlink.net. Thank you for listening, and I'll be back next week. Thank you.